Hello! Welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay. With me, as always, is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm doing well. I'm here with my shovel, and I'm ready to joust.
I also have a shovel.
I'm going to start yelling at you because you keep trying to steal men from me.
Well, you know.
And by men, I mean dogs.
Listen, I can't help it. It's not me. I mean, it is me, but I'm not doing it on purpose. Today, we are doing a movie that is not on our list, but is our very first listener request.
Yes.
By a friend of Amanda's.
Yes.
And I guess a friend of mine and a friend of the show.
Yes.
Whose name is Leona.
Correct.
I'm really glad I got that on the fly. she requested, or asked us anyway, when we were going to do Death Becomes Her.
Yes.
And so,
it was more of a presumption.
Yes.
Yeah, you will do Death Becomes Her.
Yeah.
When will that happen?
She is how old?
She turned 12.
Clearly not a listener of the show, otherwise she would know the concept, which is we have a list we work from.
She is
Death
she
Becomes
is
Her is not on the list.
Sporadic and a discerning listener. She
yes.
only she picks and chooses.
Yes.
What she listens to.
But since her birthday was coming up in April, I said, "You know what? We'll do it in April." So, yeah. This is for Leona. We are doing Death Becomes Her from 1992. It is not on our list, but it has a 58% Rotten Tomatoes score, which honestly, a little shocking.
Yeah, kind of upsetting. Kind of makes me mad.
Yeah.
This movie is amazing.
And a 62% audience score, which also still feels kind of low.
Yeah.
Had you seen it before?
I had. I know I saw it quite a while ago, and then sometime in like the COVID years. Mm-hmm. I forget if we did like a group watch of it or if I just unilaterally was
might have.
I want to watch this movie.
Because I definitely watched this with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember if that was just us or if we were watching it with the only
people
other time
online.
We were would have watched it with other people would be for that.
Yes.
For our COVID rewatch thing that we were doing.
Yes, yes.
Group watch.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, I mean I this is one of those movies where similar to Fright Night, the original Fright Night, every time I watch this, it gets better.
Yeah.
Like, every time I watch this, I notice, like, a little extra, like, background bit or a little detail or something, and it always just, it's not the first movie I go to when I want to rewatch something, but whenever I do rewatch it, I am reminded that it's completely delightful.
Yeah, I've seen it, this is probably the third time, maybe, because I watched it years ago, and I watched it whenever, you know, we watched it relatively recently. Recently, as in 6 years ago.
Yeah. Half of Leona's life ago.
Yeah, this is actually great. This is great for Leona, because this whole podcast, movie content, and probably the way we talk about it, is all going to be about the horrors of aging.
Yeah.
So, happy birthday, Leona.
Happy birthday. Your youth is slipping away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Faster every day. But yeah, the first time I saw this, it's one of those ones where I saw it and I was like, yeah, that was good.
Yep.
And I feel like it comes up every now and then, but I don't feel like it's one that if you brought up Death Becomes Her, I think people go, oh, that movie's great.
Yeah.
And then you say, when was the last time you watched it? And they'd be like, I don't know, like 20 years ago.
Yeah. It's funny. Cause it feels like it's had a little bit of a revival in the sense of, its reputation is much better than it used to be.
Like they just made a Broadway musical out of it last year.
That's fun.
Yeah.
That actually sounds kind of amazing and kind of hilarious. The meta level of Madeline Ashton be a kind of crappy Broadway star and then make an actual Broadway show.
It has a really quick turnaround for leads though, because they keep breaking their necks and blowing holes through the shotguns. Cause it's really difficult to do these special effects. So they just do it for real.
Oh, they just do it for real, and then they parade their corpses around stage?
Actors are expendable in New York. Come on.
Broadway actors especially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen all that jazz. I know how it works.
Yeah.
But yeah, this it's I would agree it's one that I think every time I've seen it, I've liked it a little bit more.
Yeah.
And
maybe part of that is getting older.
I think I was just going to say it feels like it's one that kind of lands differently when you're watching it.
When you also wish you had the pneumatic bra.
every day.
Everyone.
Every day.
Every day.
But we will talk about that as we get into it. But if you would like to follow us on Patreon while we talk about sequels.
Yes.
You can do that at patreon.com/thepenskefile. The month of April was Final Destination 2, and May is going to be... You know what? I can't remember what it is now off the top of my head. May is going to be... It's going to be... Oh, Psycho 2. Psycho 2.
The signs of aging,
yeah,
kids.
Yes.
They're not all physical. Some of them are mental.
Yes. Psycho 2 will be the movie for May. And also... I think this is the first time I'm saying this on the main feed, but in the month of June, we will be putting out an extra Patreon episode because Amanda and I, after the Denver Fan Expo in Denver, Colorado, will be going to the Stanley Hotel, which is, of course, the hotel that inspired Stephen King's The Shining.
Yes.
We'll be doing a ghost tour and a seance. And so we're gonna record something there.
Something spooky.
Not sure what yet. But
ghosts.
Yeah, if you have any ideas, let us know.
Creepy children.
Non-binding. We're not going to pay you for it, is what I'm trying to say. We'll take the idea, but we're not going to pay you for it. But yeah,
we'll take any generous donations of intellectual property.
Yes,
you might want
to give Kyle
us.
Knows what we're talking about. Yeah. But yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. So if you want to hear us fumble our way through that, head over to patreon.com/thepenskefile. Now, we are going to play the trailer for Death Becomes Her, and then we're going to talk about it.
Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young?
Some people will go to any length to stay young forever.
Is that someone?
It's Madeline Ashton. Oh, she was a big star in the 60s.
I thought she was dead.
Oh, madam. You look younger every day.
Thank you, Rose.
But Madeline Ashton and her old friend, Helen Sharp.
I've lost men to her before.
Mad Hell.
Are about to go too far.
A touch of magic. Drink that potion, and you'll never grow even one day older.
Bottoms up.
No warning.
Now a warning? Siempre viva! Live forever!
Ernest, I'm in the morgue. They think I'm dead.
You are, but you're not.
Are you telling me it doesn't hurt when I do this?
It doesn't hurt.
She's dead!
She's dead, Ernest.
Now he's dead.
He's dead? Ernest is dead? Everybody's dead!
You pushed me down the stairs.
I'm so sweaty.
I don't think it's sweat, honey. I think you're defrosting.
Universal Pictures presents Meryl Streep, Bruce Willis.
It's a miracle!
And Goldie Hawn.
Look at me! I'm soaking wet!
Death Becomes Her.
I just have to make a telephone call.
Okay. Death Becomes Her from 1992, directed by Robert Zemeckis, written by Martin Donovan and David Koepp. David Koepp, the writer of Jurassic Park, among other films.
Oh.
Just had a, he's got like, I think the last three Steven Soderbergh movies that have come out in like the,
oh,
like in the last year and a half have all been written by him.
Wow.
He wrote Presence, that ghost movie.
Yeah, yeah.
He also wrote Black Bag, which was like the spy thriller thing.
One.
That was pretty good.
That was good.
That was... You saw that with us. We saw that together, right?
Nope.
Anyway, going to see that movie.
Signs of Aging. Anyway.
It just all blends together. We watch so many movies together. We don't have any friends our age, so we just go to the movies all the time. That going to see that movie was like the first time I felt like I had gone to see a lowercase a adult film. Because like that movie is would not be interesting to anybody under the age of 40, I don't
think. No, God,
no. Or 35, rather.
Yeah.
Because
I count myself as over the age of 40, spiritually and mentally.
Because it's good, but it's like, it's very dry. It's very like...
Very talky.
Very talky.
Yeah.
Relationships, spy stuff. But
I
like,
love spy stuff.
But
I'm
it's not like
that shit.
It's not like action spy stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's bad. Mm. I'm just saying the kids aren't coming out to see Black Bag, unfortunately. And I think the next one he's got coming out, which is with Ian McKellen, plays a painter or something. I think he wrote. Oh. I think he wrote that one as well.
Is that one like The Christophers or something?
Yeah, something like that. Looks it look that looks like a movie I would see as a trailer on every VHS I rented, but never actually saw. And wasn't convinced actually existed.
Gonna win some award,
probably.
Yeah.
And it stars. This is Death Becomes Her, not The Christophers. Stars Mama from Mamma Mia, Private Benjamin from Private Benjamin, Hudson Hawk from Hudson Hawk, Blue Velvet from Blue Velvet, a bunch of other people, sorta, and a great cameo from Sydney Pollack.
Blue Velvet from Blue Velvet.
That's her name. Amanda, what happens in Death Becomes Her?
Two women vie for a man and the secret of eternal beauty.
Yeah, sure.
I am really enjoying how angry these summaries are starting to make
you. You know, it's like, how much efficiency is too much efficiency?
We're finding the line.
Yeah, it's like you can really cut things down to the bone, but then eventually you start chipping the bone.
The next summaries are just going to be a movie.
Yeah. Two characters interact and conflict arises.
See, that was longer than the one I just read.
That's true.
Well, Clay, some things you'll find in Death Becomes Her include frenemies.
Frenemies, the most deadly relationship two women could have.
I was going to say, like you and I.
Yeah. Two women.
You'll also find fat suits.
So, the Hollywood fat suit.
Yeah, it's such an artifact.
Yeah, it doesn't really exist anymore. Does it?
I mean,
every now and then. I shouldn't say that having watched The Penguin, which is...
That's exactly what I was just
thinking. But that's like, that's not the same thing. Because there's the Penguin, but then there's the fat suit for comedic purposes, which is what this is.
Sure.
And this and like The Nutty Professor and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and
Shallow Hal.
Yeah, there's always something so, I don't know, slimy about it. I don't know. Go ahead.
No, in a movie like this that came out in 1992, I think of it very much as like an artifact of its time.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like a cheap shot, right?
Yeah.
Like it's just sort of like, we're supposed to understand she's let herself go and she's crazy now and horrible. We can tell because she is fat.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, but she's also like watching and rewinding the scene of her frenemy getting killed in a movie over and over again. Like,
right.
I think we can get this across in more clever ways.
Yeah.
Funnier ways.
The way they shoot it too, like they specifically do like close-ups on her huge ass.
Yeah.
And the big reveal where they like push in as she turns into the camera. It's like, oh my God, she's fat now.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird relic, I think.
It is. Yeah. I'm kind of glad we've moved past that, if for no other reason than it is it's not interesting, right?
Like
other ways of if you want to have it be a joke or you want to show what the mental state of a character is, there's like more clever and interesting ways to do that than just be like, put her in a fat suit and then take her out of the fat suit.
Right.
And they'll be like, whoa, she's hot again.
Which, if we were going to make this movie now, they would do something a lot more culturally acceptable.
Oh, boy.
Which is they would hire a large person to play the role and then CGI Goldie Hawn's face onto the body, which is better.
Yeah.
It's better.
Sure. Anyway, you'll also find fake French accents.
Yeah. When she goes to the... when Meryl Streep goes to
the pastel colored surgery in the basement,
and the one you can tell I don't go to these places. What would you call that woman? She like the person who's telling her she can't get the procedure.
An esthetician.
Yeah, there you go.
A beautician.
She's got this really over the top French accent. I'm like, what is this? And then when her boss comes in, scares her, she immediately drops the accent.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, that's funny.
That was funny.
I thought it was just like, isn't French funny? But it's like, okay, no, she's, I think my view of this movie, I think turned on a bit of a dime in that scene, because I was like, okay, this is, I'm liking this. Then the fat suit thing, like, all right, this is a cheap joke. And then the French thing, like, all right, this feels like a cheap joke. But then when it was kind of like they rug pulled that a little bit, I was like, okay, all right.
Yeah, there's there's a bunch of little things like that throughout this movie that make me really appreciate it.
Yeah.
You'll also find a great car explosion.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Big fan. Always.
You know, we did Final Destination 2 on Patreon.
Yes, we did.
And we talked for almost 2 hours about it.
Yeah, longer than the movie.
And I really didn't get to talk about how much I love the car explosions in that.
You absolutely did get to talk about
that.
Did I? Yes.
We should talk about it again on this episode.
Don't think we need to.
Oh, fine.
Look, we can save some time for the end.
Fine.
If we're running short, you can talk more about car explosions.
Okay.
This is how I bribe Clay to do things all the time.
Yeah.
You'll also find a powerful sexual being named Ernest or a tragic, boozy, flaccid clown.
Hey, ¿por qué no los dos? No?
He contains multitudes.
Yes.
Yeah. Elevator dogs.
I miss the elevator dogs.
When she goes to Liesl's house for the first time.
Oh, that's right.
And the yes. elevator comes up and two Dobermen just get off the elevator and walk into the other room.
Yep.
Love it. The sordid topic of coin.
Yes.
A really terrible murder plot.
Yeah.
Helen's plot to kill Madeline is bad.
It's too busy.
Yeah.
I you know, she really rips into Ernest
yeah.
after he knocks her down the stairs.
Yeah.
Honestly, his plan is better.
His plan is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Elegant simplicity.
Yeah. But she doesn't want that, though. She wants no. to. She wants her to suffer.
She wants her to suffer. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of which, a hell of a stairfall stunt.
Yeah. The falling down the stairs stuff in this is incredible.
So good.
They do it twice.
Yeah.
And they do it the same way twice, which is they fall down a set of stairs that's maybe like 30 stairs, but it's like they're falling down yeah. 500 stairs. Yeah, it's incredible.
It just keeps going. A doctor who is scared to death.
Yes, that's played by Sidney Pollack, who was just, man, hitting dingers. He's in there for maybe 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Killer.
Yeah,
killer
he's so cameo. Good.
And then when they reveal that he's died, yeah. it's very funny.
A brutal tennis injury.
Yeah, another background thing. When they go to the hospital, in the background, yeah. They push in. They do a close up very quickly of mm-hmm. someone who's it's a hospital in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
So like the people in the waiting room, there's one woman in like a beautiful party dress with a glass of champagne.
Yes.
I didn't see who she was with and what was wrong with that person.
Yeah.
But the other two are two people in tennis outfits.
Yes.
A man and a woman. The man, his knees are just covered in blood,
mm-hmm.
and he still has the tennis racket.
Yeah.
Which is bent in half.
Yeah. Shovel fight.
Gotta love a shovel fight. I'm a big fan of fighting using objects you wouldn't think to use like a sword and fighting with them like swords.
Yeah, yeah. Like shovels, turn this into a jousting.
Chainsaws. I'm here for it.
You name it.
Yeah.
Clay's here for it. An absolutely enormous glass of whiskey.
Yeah, that glass of whiskey they pour him at the end is
yeah, it's
preposterous.
Like insane.
But it's great.
It's enough to kill a man.
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't even have had to. If he had drank that, he probably wouldn't have woken back up.
Yeah, they probably never would have gotten him to take the potion. A secret cabal of the uber wealthy.
Got to have it.
We wouldn't know anything about those.
No, those don't exist.
No.
No.
Fiction. A medieval castle overlooking L.A.
You know, I didn't look up to see if that place is real. It wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me either, but it is also really funny to me.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, up in the hills,
mm-hmm.
giant, enormous medieval castle.
Yeah. Most of the houses up there are basically like loosely stapled to the side of a mountain. So maybe maybe they wouldn't be able to put a whole castle up there.
Loosely stapled. You'll also find Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, Andy Warhol, Jim Morrison, James Dean, and Greta Garbo.
Yeah. I did not remember this scene.
Mm.
But as soon as the guy comes out and says, I'd like to remind you to refrain from coming out of your fake death to cause headlines. As soon as yeah. he said that, it was like, oh, yeah. Elvis.
Yep.
Because it doesn't happen anymore. But in the early 90s, it was like a big
people were spotting Elvis
tabloid
everywhere.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
People seeing Elvis everywhere.
People seeing Elvis everywhere.
You know, it's...
We don't see fun celebrities everywhere now.
Dead ones, you mean?
Well, like just dead ones or just sightings. It just feels now like instead all of the conspiracy theories are about, you know, super dark shit.
Yeah. I knew we hit a really rough patch when the tabloids started breaking real news.
Yep.
And it was shit that like 10 years ago, it's the same story they would have run, but you would have been like, oh, isn't that silly?
Yeah. Now instead it's like, oh no.
Yeah. The fact that TMZ is like a reliable news source is kind of disturbing.
Gross. And you'll also find the Menville Marriage Counseling Clinic and the Menville Center for the Study of Women.
Yes. What a man he became. Okay. Death Becomes Her. This is 1992. Yes. So this is Robert Zemeckis after Back to the Future, after Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Mm.
Robert Zemeckis is a...
human man.
He's a human man who loves special effects.
Mm.
He is always going to... Basically every movie he makes after the Back to the Future trilogy, and I guess counting those as well, are all driven by special effects centerpieces.
Sure.
Essentially. Sometimes they work better than others. You know, you win. Sometimes you win an Oscar for Forrest Gump.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you do... what's the Christmas Railroad movie? Beowulf or something like that, where it's like, sure.
Yeah, were you thinking about the Polar Express?
Polar Express.
Okay.
Christmas train movie where Tom Hanks plays every character.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's all that like motion cap animation, yeah. Creepy face
before
stuff?
They like really figured it out.
Yeah. I would argue they've barely figured it out.
Yeah.
So.
It's weird because I think like he very much gets excited about new stuff, but I think he tends to push it too far before it's ready.
Right. He's too ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Like James Cameron basically will spend 10 years waiting for the technology to get up to speed.
Yeah. For better or worse. Yes.
Yeah. Whereas Robert Zemeckis is like, hey, we got a movie to make.
Yep.
We'll just try it.
Figure it out.
But, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, and I'm not going to ask you.
Okay.
But I'm of two minds about that kind of thing, because on the one hand, it's can be jarring to watch when you watch something like that. That is a new thing that hasn't really reached its full potential. Not that I'm saying that's what this is, but just in general.
Mm.
However, someone's got to be the first person to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And
if you can pull it off.
Yeah.
Then it's a really impressive like spectacle for the audience.
Like as much as I dislike the Star Wars prequels and I mean, some people might also see this as a negative. The Star Wars prequels basically laid out the roadmap for how movies have been made for the past 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, like that was, those movies are basically a giant ad for Industrial Light and Magic.
Yes.
For better or worse.
Yeah.
I feel like he can't quite, he's one of those directors that keeps going bigger and rarely remembers how to go smaller.
Yeah.
Like every now and then he'll do something like Flight or Castaway, Castaway, I don't know if you know this. You know the movie What Lies Beneath?
Yes.
So they shot that in the middle of Castaway because they were waiting for Tom Hanks's body to change.
Oh.
I can't remember if they shot the, I think they were waiting for him to either, they were either waiting for him to slim down or get
gain
bigger.
Weight. Yeah.
But they had to wait like 6 months. And
oh
so they shot What Lies Beneath while they were waiting for Tom Hanks.
I mean,
why not?
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway, how do you feel about these things?
How do I feel about these things? How do I feel about Robert Zemeckis and his ambitious filmmaking?
Yes.
I think overall I admire it, even when it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because he does always seem to be trying new stuff and to go bigger and improve upon what he did in the past and not stay stagnant.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's the kind of director where his formula, when it works so well.
Yep.
That he could just sit in that pocket and kind of make the same movie again and again and again and again.
He's one of the few directors that I think has a lifetime blank check.
Yes.
Like, whatever he wants to make.
Yeah.
They just throw money at him. Because at the very worst, it's a curiosity.
Yes.
And at the best, it wins every Oscar ever out.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think the only way you get to that point is if you are somebody who is willing to keep changing and keep trying new stuff. I do understand that, sometimes some of his movies he pushes... he pushes a little too far too fast, mm-hmm. and it doesn't come across probably the way he hoped.
Yeah.
Luckily, I think this is one of the movies where it really works.
Yes. So this comes out a year before Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. and Jurassic Park is generally considered the coming out party for CGI. But this has a ton of CGI in it,
mm-hmm.
and it still looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, there are movies that came out after this that have less CGI that looks worse.
Yes. Yeah, there are movies in, like, the 2000s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That have less CGI and look much worse than this.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons it works here is because they kind of pick their battles a little bit.
Yeah.
Because they're still using kind of a mix of CGI and practical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, there's some aspects of Meryl Streep's head getting crushed in that are like a puppet sort of, or animatronic,
right,
or whatever.
Right, or when her head's twisted around.
Yeah.
They're clearly doing some clever
Yeah, and they're adding
like
some
that.
Makeup in certain places and yeah, stuff. Yeah. So I think it still has a nice mix,
mm-hmm.
that I'm glad he didn't try to push it too far.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, the place I think they could have pushed it too far, mm-hmm. that would have been awful,
mm-hmm.
is the final scene when they fall down the stairs and yes. shatter into pieces.
Yes, yeah.
Like, they just had a dummy that they broke
yep.
there. I'm kind of shocked they didn't go CGI, make the bodies explode.
Mm-hmm. Or have all the different body pieces, parts of the body, like, crawling around in the background or something.
Yeah.
I think there's, like, yeah. one hand that's, like, impatiently tapping on the ground.
Yep.
And then it's just their heads.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you like Robert Zemeckis generally, the stuff that he does?
Generally, yes.
Back to the Future. I'm saying this for the people, not for you. Back to the Future, Romancing the Stone, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, this... Forrest Gump, Castaway.
Yeah, I'm sort of middling to positive.
A Christmas Carol, where Jim Carrey plays every character.
I have not seen that.
Yeah, so that one's not great.
I do not intend to.
Yeah.
I think when his stuff works, it works really, really well.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like there's not really a modern day, like, a newer equivalent to what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no, like, the new Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah. He kind of...
Like, he fills this great niche where he does a bunch of genre stuff, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't necessarily call it, like, family-friendly, but it
yeah,
is...
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
That sort of more broadly approachable, and it's going to satisfy a lot of different audiences.
Yeah.
Again, when it works, and then sometimes when it does not. It's sort of like meh.
Yeah. I always get a little excited when I hear he has something coming out because, like I was saying, at the very least, it's going to be an interesting failure.
Yeah.
Generally. This, on the other hand, I think I'm surprised that it was kind of a failure because this movie's great.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I meant earlier when I said that I think it maybe hasn't had the same, like, cult revival that some movies have received in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think when you go online, if you Google this movie, its reputation is much better now than it used to be.
Yeah.
Like, I even kind of remember the attitude when I was a kid about this movie. Like, I kind of remember the attitude around me being like, oh, that movie's stupid. That movie's dumb. It doesn't make any sense. It's just, like, weird. It's not funny. It's just like, that movie is stupid. It's, like, just, you know, like, people kind of seem like they didn't know what to make of it.
I can see that.
Yeah. Because
this is a very, it's not really tonally strange because the tone is actually pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see this being kind of a hard sell. Because it kind of has some horror elements, but it has a lot of comedy elements, and those traditionally that's kind of a hard circle to square marketing-wise.
Yeah.
What it feels like to me, which makes perfect sense because Robert Zemeckis was involved with the show, it feels like a big episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah.
And I think Tales from the Crypt, the show, started before this, but, and I guess... Originally, this was kind of, that started in 1989. This was kind of considered a Tales from the Crypt movie briefly. But then I guess they changed it for whatever reason. But yeah, Zemeckis loves that stuff. And this definitely has the tone of a Tales from the Crypt episode. There's actually, there actually is an episode directed by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh,
strangely enough.
Okay.
Where this old man falls in love with this young woman, old rich guy. And he goes to this clinic where they're like, well, you know, what do you think is wrong with you? He's like, oh, my legs are too small. I was like, well, we can fix that for you. And they have this like super buff dude and they basically take the legs off of him. They switch their legs.
Okay.
And so long story short, he ends up doing his entire body. So he's totally ripped, but he still has this weird old man voice, which is funny. And the girl he loves ends up going off with the old man because she finds out he's rich. But yeah, like that's the kind of vibe this has. That's the kind of,
a little bit of that monkey's paw thing.
Yeah. The dark, dark morality. The only thing that that would make this more of a Tales from the Crypt is if Ernest also had some sort of darkly ironic end.
Yes.
Which, I mean, maybe his end is kind of ironic, but it's not really dark.
I don't really even think it's ironic.
No.
I think he gets like an undeserved happy ending, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think my biggest problem with this movie is like the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But we can get to that in a bit.
20 minutes.
Yeah. I do want to say something which may be extremely controversial.
Uh-oh.
Meryl Streep's a really good actress.
You're fired. You're fired.
Someone had to say it. Someone had to say it. I think it
One has ever said that before. You know that?
No, literally no one.
No.
No. Even when she wins awards, they don't say it.
No.
They just kind of, they give her
Everyone turns around and refuses to clap.
The host gives her a knowing nod.
Yep.
And she goes away silently.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things where it's become such a cliche that when you say when you want to invoke the name of or the idea of a great actress, you say Meryl Streep.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's very easy to forget how good she actually is.
Yes.
Especially now, like she's still doing great work now, but it's a little less. She's having a little more fun now, I think.
Yeah, she's earned some leeway.
Yeah.
To play around a little bit more with some stuff.
But man, she is incredible in this.
Yeah,
I didn't know she had such a good singing voice. That's where I stopped watching. I assume the rest of it's pretty good too.
You thought this entire movie was just her doing a Broadway show?
Yeah, and I was here for it.
You were here for it
until I shut it off.
The scene where she is grappling with her age, like after Goldie has come back, Helena has come back. Helen. And Helen has returned to her life and is young and gorgeous looking. And Meryl Streep's character, Madeline, is starting to really feel her age and really notice her age. And she is throwing herself into a despair. That whole sequence where she, like, tries to go to the clinic and they won't treat her. And then she tries to go home and hook up with her pool boy side piece. And he is sleeping with a young woman and she's horribly hurt and she ends up caught outside in the rain. And then she goes in the car and she's sobbing in the car and driving and she sees her own reflection and she screams.
Yes.
And like the whole thing at Liesl's house, like she's so funny. And so just everything she does is so good in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine if anyone else had been cast in that role. I don't think this movie would have worked.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I guess when she first, I don't know, I'm assuming she did an audition. I assume they came to her. I think when she first read the script, she thought they wanted her to play Helen.
Oh.
Which, makes a little more sense on the surface, because like you don't really think of Meryl Streep as going this big generally, and she's maybe not as traditionally gorgeous as some other Hollywood, like Goldie Hawn is usually portrayed as like the traditionally gorgeous
you know,
blonde or whatever.
Yeah.
So having them kind of switch is a little fun.
Yeah.
But I, man, she has to do so much more. All respect due to Goldie Hawn. Mm. Meryl Streep has so much more to do in this.
Yeah.
And yes. She just nails it.
Yeah.
Like that, the way that she berates Ernest right before he throws her down the stairs is incredible.
Mm.
I think my favorite thing about her performance in this is the small bits.
Yes.
Because she's doing a lot of stuff like after the fact or after the line that's really, really funny. And one of my favorites is at the end when they're trying to get, when Ernest is hanging from his suspenders and they're yelling at him to take the potion.
Yes.
She says, take the potion or whatever the line is, 55 different ways.
Yeah.
And they're all gold.
Yes.
They're all very good.
Yeah. Yeah. And even just like the scenes of her in Isabella Rossellini's Castle on the Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, like, very weirded out about where she's at, but also extremely intrigued and nosy, but also trying to play it cool. And every time, like, the camera will stay on her, and when Isabella Rossellini's character turns her head, she'll, like, lean over to peer at something or make a face or do something. And then the minute she turns back, she, like, recomposes herself, and you get to see her do it instantaneously. It's so good.
Yeah. I kind of wish she had done more comedy.
Yeah.
I guess, let me put it this way. I think she's done comedy since.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if she's done comedy with as quality of a production as this.
Yeah. And I mean, a movie like this, like,
she's really good on Only Murders in the Building.
Oh, I haven't gotten to I got to one of the seasons with her in it, and I kind of fell off on that show.
So you're telling me a liar? You don't think she's good in that season? That's why you stopped watching it?
I only saw like one or two episodes, and she hadn't taken a full step forward. So she was kind of just like, is this a cameo?
Spit, just trying to spin it all the time.
Spin what?
Exactly. Go on.
You're trying to derail this whole episode.
No. I did that a long time ago.
Derailed the whole show. I lost what I was going to say.
Sorry.
Now you have to fill in. Anyway, Clay.
Yeah, sorry. she's great.
I really completely spaced on what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. You did this to me.
I think the interplay with her and Goldie is really good. I think the interplay with her and Bruce Willis is really good.
Yeah.
Maybe I haven't seen enough things with Goldie Hawn in it.
Mm.
I've never really been a Goldie Hawn person.
Yeah, I don't know what I've seen. I know what I'm sure I've seen her in things other than this, but I can't think of anything.
Have you seen Overboard?
No.
No? Do you know the plot of Overboard?
Is that the mermaid one?
No, that's Splash.
Okay.
With Daryl Hannah. Overboard is her and Kurt Russell, her husband, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if this is where where they met, because I don't think they're married.
Oh.
I think they're one of those long-term Susan Sarandon type relationships.
Good for them.
Yeah. That was the only reason I was doing that. It's because Kurt Russell was doing it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
told your wife that?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
The plot of Overboard is Goldie Hawn basically gets amnesia, and so Kurt Russell convinces her that she's his wife.
Cool.
And it's a comedy.
I'm sure it's very charming and funny.
Yeah, I've actually never seen it.
But it's one of those ones where it could only have been made.
Yeah, if you watch the trailer, it's like, oh, yeah, they don't make these anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I really appreciate in this movie where, like, each of these characters could be completely loathsome.
Mm-hmm.
But each of them is somewhat sympathetic.
Yeah.
In the course of the story, like, they all have their moments where you kind of feel bad for them or you are charmed by them. And I think the performances really are what makes that work so well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Especially with Madeline's character, where she is the villain initially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's very much the bad guy at first. She comes in and she steals Helen's fiance and ruins her life. And it's kind of an interesting structure in this movie where it starts and it feels like you're going to be very much in Helen's point of view for the vast majority. And instead you actually spend most of it with Madeline.
Yeah.
And then you've got Ernest in the middle, who is like portrayed as this sort of bumbling and ineffectual fool. But it's also, he's played by Bruce Willis, who is just, he's so funny and mm-hmm. like, even when he's not likable, he's enjoyable to watch. So it makes it hard to hate him.
Right.
Straight out. Like, and he's so, especially after a point, he's so at the mercy of these two women that you don't look at him and you're like, ah, what a conniving asshole. You know, like, instead you're kind of like, well, you're getting what you deserve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because it actually has the story dynamics of a wrestling storyline.
Mm.
Because you've got Goldie, who's playing the baby face, mm-hmm. Madeline playing the heel.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually Goldie does a heel turn.
Yep.
And you start kind of rooting for Madeline, even though she hasn't changed her character.
Yeah.
But she's now sympathetic because Goldie has hit her in the back with a chair.
Yes.
So to speak.
A metaphorical chair. Yeah.
And we were talking about Meryl Streep doing comedy when I so rudely threw you off the trail.
Yeah, I still don't have it.
Okay. But yeah, how do you feel about Goldie Hawn in this?
I like her, mm-hmm. and I think she does a good job with the character. I think part of the problem is the character's not really given a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're clearly supposed to think of her as sort of mousy and
shy
early
on. I'm shocked they did not give her glasses at the beginning
of this. Yeah. She's got sort of a boring haircut, and she's clearly
frizzy hair.
Yeah, she's clearly a little bit of the church mouse kind of style.
Always wearing like tweed or something.
Yes, yeah, very conservatively dressed, and she takes her fiance Ernest for some reason to come see her frenemy on Broadway.
He had to pass the Madeline test.
He had to pass the Madeline test, and he failed.
Yep.
But that scene is so funny because of Bruce Willis, like when he's just like, wow, she's fantastic, and he's so into her, and everyone else in the crowd is like, this is garbage, and they're getting up and they're leaving because they think she's so bad.
Yeah.
Which
is, that's okay, so that's one point
where
I think Meryl Streep is too good of an actress.
Yeah,
because I'm watching that going like, when they talk, she's pretty good.
Yeah.
Of course, the play that she's in is a musical version of the Song of Youth. Is that what it was?
The Sweet
Bird of Youth, which is a Tennessee Williams play, which is not a joke I got at the time.
No.
I had to look it up. But it's a joke very similar to the musical version of Streetcar Named Desire from The Simpsons, where they've taken a play that is, I'm only going to assume, is a fairly earnest drama.
Yes.
And turned it into a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
But like, that whole scene is pretty good. Like, she's great.
Yeah, it's tough because they definitely made the song bad.
Yeah.
You know, like the lyrics are terrible and it's very kitschy and kind of cliched, but like, she's still just fabulous to watch.
So right.
Yeah. It makes that, the fact that everybody is storming out in the middle of the show, a little less believable.
Do you think it would have been easier to track if it had been a serious play and she just wasn't pulling it off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would have been an easier way to highlight the mismatch, or have her very overtly playing a character who's supposed to be like way younger than she is.
Yeah. Something like
that. Or something like that, to have there be some sort of like overt dissonance between the two.
Cause especially once things get going, it feels like she's just playing herself in that play.
Yeah.
Cause like,
yeah,
big costumes, glamorous hair, very glamorous person.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you'd asked about Goldie, and I think Goldie Hawn does a good job with the character. I think like there's some really funny bits with her, which are always really fun. And once she gets shot in the middle with the shotgun and gets more to do, I think she pulls all that off really well.
Yeah.
But other than that, she's kind of not given a whole heck of a lot in the like middle portion of the movie. Right?
Yeah, she kind of disappears for a lot of it.
Yeah, she's showing up in her one good dress.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to connive a way to tempt Ernest away from Madeline and then eventually get rid of Madeline entirely.
Yeah.
And we get her sort of like conniving a little bit. And then she goes back to the, I don't know, the hotel room she's staying in or whatever it is. She's kind of like, oh, all right.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. I think she's fine. I think she does. She does. She's a pretty good comedic actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what she does in this is pretty solid. But
yeah.
It's again, I think Meryl Streep is just doing more stuff.
Yeah.
Not that Goldie is giving like a nuanced performance, so to speak. But Meryl Streep just has more to do. Even after the shenanigans really start,
mm-hmm.
like Goldie gets a hole blown in her midsection.
Yeah.
That's kind of it.
Right.
Whereas,
Madeline gets her
thrown down the stairs. Yeah. Her head turned on backwards.
Her turned on backwards again.
Smushed into her body into cavity her like a turtle.
Yeah.
You know, her neck is broken a number of times.
She gets to do the walking around with your head facing one way, and she gets to say, "I can see my ass."
I should have done the Spaceballs thing. Because why didn't somebody tell me my ass was so big? Yeah, Bruce Willis.
Mm.
You know, he's one of those guys where, again, I think it's easy to forget how, especially now in the past handful of years where he really had a downturn because of his health. And before people knew it was his health, you know, a lot of people, myself included, were clowning on the movies he was making because they were bad.
Yeah.
And usually was just him in a room with an earpiece in being fed the lines,
which
it's unfortunately speaks to, I think, the kind of ego reputation that he had, that people saw that and didn't immediately think, oh, this guy's sick.
Right.
It's like, oh, he just doesn't want to learn the lines.
Yeah. And I think that is a little bit of a, there are other actors who would do shit like that.
Oh yeah.
And so we all as the public are kind of accustomed to hearing these stories of the wild egotism of actors.
Right.
And so,
right.
Yeah. Our tendency is to believe that it is just somebody who's like, I can't be bothered, rather than somebody who is genuinely struggling and sick.
Yeah. But that aside, I think he's another one who it's just really easy now to forget how good of an actor he is.
Yeah.
I don't think he fully suppresses the Bruce Willis thing here, but I think he does a really good job of it because he's not really projecting Bruce Willis through the mustache and the bad hair and the glasses.
Right, the glasses.
For instance, there's a movie.
Schlubby outfits and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a movie called Executive Decision, which is a really boring title for an action movie.
Uh-huh.
But it's about, it's kind of like The Rock, but on a plane.
Okay.
And instead of Nicolas Cage being the computer geek who has to save the day, it's Kurt Russell.
Okay.
And it's Kurt Russell with his incredible head of hair and like the smallest pair of glasses. And so you get to the point where it's like, oh, I can't do this. I'm just a computer guy. Yeah. It's like, that's Snake Plissken.
Yeah. It is really funny when movies try to make somebody like Kurt Russell seem like he's not really cool.
The irony of it is that was Kurt Russell kind of trying to play every man.
Mm-hmm.
But after The Rock, Nicolas Cage turned into an action hero.
Yes.
Inexplicably.
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway.
But a lot of people would say Bruce Willis was turned into an action hero inexplicably.
Yeah.
Right? Didn't he start on Moonlighting? And everybody thought he was just like that guy who was funny from Moonlighting.
Yeah. He was kind of a risky choice to be given Die Hard when they did. But yeah, he manages to not project through that. Like Sylvester Stallone can't do that.
Right.
It's always glasses. In Tango and Cash, also with Kurt Russell, Sylvester Stallone is supposed to play this like, you know, buttoned up whatever.
But he's also still built like Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah. And well, he's got the glasses on. Yeah. He's got little tiny thin-rimmed glasses.
At least in this movie, they made an effort to make Bruce Willis look schlubby.
Yeah. He's got the glasses are covering a lot of his face.
He's not super buff.
Yeah.
Not that he ever gets super buff in his movies, but he's even less buff in this one. Very much on purpose because he's supposed to be a plastic surgeon.
And I think that his character is... could very easily go over the line of silliness, but I think he plays it pretty perfectly.
Yeah, and I think he also could go over the line into just being kind of loathsome.
Yeah.
Like somebody who's just like, oh, he's either such a wimp and such a weenie, or he's so ready to betray whichever of the women he is with at the moment that he could have easily tipped into like, ugh, I hate this guy. I hope they throw him down the stairs.
Yeah.
And instead there's like, he's just so hapless and like caught in between these two much stronger personalities that you can't help but feel a little bad for him.
Yeah. It's, I would say the one thing that stops from making him completely sympathetic is the fact that he straight up leaves Helen for Madeline.
Yes.
Because like him being...
And you never see why.
Right. Yeah. Him being caught in the middle...
Yes.
...is a really fun dynamic. And I think my favorite part of the movie, as far as he's concerned, this plot line anyway, is when the two women just resort to having a shovel fight.
Yes.
And Bruce Willis just like... They stop paying attention to him.
Yep.
And he very... slowly walks upstairs and just like goes to bed.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's like, that's that aspect of the whole thing is great, that he's just really caught between these two women who are only really using him as a chess piece and not as a person. But he still leaves Helen for Madeline.
Right. And when we meet him, he and Helen, at least from Helen's point of view, they are genuinely in love.
Yeah.
Like, she's not a bombshell at the time. She seems like a fairly normal person, and she seems like she really wants to marry him and is really in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's confirmed towards the end of the movie when she and Madeline have their sword fight that results in them finally having a heart-to-heart. And she says... You took him just because you could.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even be
just
this...
Just like Jolene.
Yeah, but she's like, she says something like, I wouldn't be as angry if you had taken him because you actually cared about him, but you didn't. And I did.
Yeah.
I really loved him. I really was in love with him. I really wanted to marry him. And you took him just to hurt me. And that is where you like, that's where why, like, ultimately my sympathy, I think, in the end really does lie with Helen. Despite everything she does in the middle of the movie, because she is the one who started off trying to be the good person.
Right.
Right. Like she just wanted her relationship and she wanted to be with the person she loved and get married and like live happily ever after. And instead she was trapped with these two jerks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Who really deserve each other more than, than anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think ultimately, she is driven off the edge, which it's tough to falter completely when it comes to that, you know. But yeah, as far as he's concerned, I think he's just I think as much as I don't know how I feel about the final sequence of the movie, I do think the funeral is kind of the wrap up for his character.
Yeah.
In that his character up until the point where he leaves is just this ping pong ball.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have any willpower.
Yeah.
He is just being tossed back and forth. But what you learn at the funeral is that he finally did take control of his life and actually did, you know, was assertive with himself and the people around him and stuff and actually lived a great life.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of evens things out a bit. But you don't really expect that. Well, we could talk about the end in a minute.
Yeah. It is also kind of weird because he does kill Madeline.
He does.
Like he kills her. He's a murderer and he fully gets away with it and then and gets to live this like great life.
It's interesting. You know, there's That scene is very reminiscent to me of, do you remember the, in Creepshow? Have you seen Creepshow?
Yes.
The story with the monster in the box.
It's been a really long time. I'm trying to remember.
Anyway.
Yeah.
The beginning of that story is Hal Holbrook plays this guy who's married to Adrienne Barbeau.
Mm.
And Adrienne Barbeau is just a complete ass to him.
Uh-huh.
Constantly beating him down, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a scene towards the beginning where she goes on like basically a very similar rant to the one that Madeline does.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden she gets her brains blown out and the camera turns around and Hal Holbrook has a gun and he blows the smoke up, but it's a dream.
Ah.
And it's the same kind of thing where it's like, okay, I mean, you know, just kill your wife, I guess. It's a bit much, but
yeah, it makes it a little hard to fully root for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, he does kill her.
He does kill her. He has a chance to save her, and then because she's a jerk, he doesn't even just let her fall. He pokes her.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He kills her.
That's he's doing that because he's under the influence of Helen, though. He's not in his right mind. He's drunk.
First you apologize for Jimmy Savile.
No court on earth would convict this man in 1992. Yeah.
That's probably now, true.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
This would be the Karen Reed trial of its time.
Oh, my God.
Before we move on, we should probably talk about Isabella Rossellini, who somehow looks younger in this than she did in Blue Velvet, which was 10 years before.
Understand.
She looks incredible.
She took the potion for real.
Yeah.
She looks fucking amazing. She's living like the best life I could possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm.
She has a giant castle in the hills. She's got multiple dogs.
Never wears a shirt.
Never has to wear a shirt. Why would you if you looked like that? She's got Tom, Dick, and Harry all waiting for her.
Chippendales dancers. All with headsets on for some reason.
So she can summon them wherever she might be. And an indoor swimming pool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much it.
Coolest life ever.
Hangs out with Elvis and Marilyn Monroe and James Dean. Yeah. What do you think those guys are doing?
In the movie or?
Just like.
Like in the movie where they're pretending to be dead?
Yeah.
Just, I don't know.
I find it funny that obviously.
If you're James Dean, I guess just being sexy.
I guess. Driving a car poorly.
Well, you can now because you're never going to die.
Well, but you do, though.
Well, true. This is a complicated kind of immortality, right?
You can't really think about it
too
hard.
It's not really immortality if you're dead.
Yeah. When they revealed Elvis.
I think he even says, like, because you had mentioned earlier that it's Liesl, Isabella Rossellini's character, or Chagall, like, one of those people are saying, like, just a reminder, please do not reveal yourself in your death. You are supposed to be dead. And I think it cuts to Elvis, and in the very Elvis voice, he's like, I was just trying to have some fun.
Yeah. I couldn't
with
help.
All the girls hanging off of him.
I just couldn't help but think, like, all of these people who were dead.
Mm-hmm.
Who are in real life dead, but in this movie have faked their death.
Mm.
Some of them, like, who was in charge of picking the method? Because if I was Elvis, I would have chosen a different way to fake my death than dying on the toilet.
I also don't believe that Andy Warhol would have been capable of faking his death and actually staying hidden. That man loved fame.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, that's the funny thing, but you run into a problem when you do this kind of thing where it's like, okay, the concept here is that these incredibly, incredibly iconic famous people who died before their time are still alive.
Yes.
But nobody knows.
Yep.
But we have to show them in recognizable versions of themselves.
Right. We have to dress Elvis like Elvis on
so
stage.
So Elvis just can't just be like in a t-shirt and jeans.
Right.
He's got to very clearly be Elvis.
Yep.
Marilyn Monroe needs to very clearly. Andy Warhol has to have that stupid haircut.
Yes.
Even though he probably would have changed it a long time ago.
Yeah, probably. Greta Garbo's the only one I believe.
Yeah.
That she was. Because isn't that whole quote that she says is, I want to be alone? And that is like, I think so. I think Liesl says it to Madeline, and Madeline's like, oh, no. Her? Really? And I think it is. I think it's Greta Garbo, and she. So I'm like, yeah, she actually wanted to be alone.
Yeah.
She was like, I'm done with this.
Was she the one who dressed up like a man? Was that what she was famous for?
I think so.
Like, dressed in the tuxedo.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of her in like suiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen anything with her in it.
It's great.
Isabel Rossellini.
Amazing.
Yeah, she's one of those actresses where similar to Greta Garbo, I don't know if I've really seen much with her in it. I mean, she's obviously had a very long career, but I think the things I know her from are Blue Velvet.
In which she plays?
Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
Title character. this movie.
Uh-huh.
And the first season of 30 Rock, where she plays Jack Donaghy's wife.
Yeah, I feel like other than that, she's been in a lot of stuff, but it's a lot of like smaller, sort of artsy, like a little off of the mainstream version. Wasn't she in she's in a movie recently where she played a nun?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, she's in The Conclave.
Thank you.
I remember. I did see that. That's a interesting movie.
I still have to see that.
Yeah, it takes a pretty hard left turn about. Oh. 20 minutes before the end, where I was like, I don't know if I believe. Anyway,
I will watch it and I will let you know what I think.
Yeah.
I love her in this so much. Mm-hmm. I think she's
great.
Perfectly cast, not only because she is so gorgeous, but because she has that sort of, like she has that exotic quality to her, and her accent is one where you might not pin it right away as like Italian. You could believe she's just from some mysterious European country. And I think she is shockingly funny in this.
Yes,
which is the thing I don't think she's given much chance to be in a lot of her other big roles, where like she's very funny in this. I love when she's trying to get Ernest to take the potion and he says, "My God," and she kind of giggles and goes, "Oh, thank you." And I believe it. Like I believe if I found myself in some sort of magical castle that had appeared on the hillside, and I walked in and I'm in this bizarre realm, and she was the one holding the magic potion, I would just be like, yep, I buy this entirely. I need no further explanation. I don't have any questions.
Yeah. wearing that thing.
Yeah, the jewels as a shirt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Walking around with a dagger in your little sarong skirt.
My question.
Yes.
Again, this is something that you probably shouldn't think about too much.
Uh-oh.
Meryl Streep says, does she say that she had to pay her entire fortune for the thing? Or is it Helen that says that? Basically, what I'm getting to is, how did Helen afford the potion?
Helen says she, well, first of all, Liesl says the price is different for everyone.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yep. So she when Madeline's asking her about the, what was it again? The sordid topic of coin.
Yes.
When Madeline asks her, she says there is no fixed price. The price is different for everyone. And she writes something on a piece of paper and holds it up.
Right, right.
We don't ever see what that is. We assume it's money. It probably is money because eventually she pays with a check. But the implication is that it is kind of, well, maybe one of those monkey's paw things, right? Where maybe sometimes some people who want it have to give up something that is more precious to them than money. In Helen's case, she later on says, I had to give everything I had. I had my entire life savings. I gave her everything for this.
It's too bad she didn't do a pro bono.
Yeah, she seemed like she was going to with Ernest.
That's true.
Yeah.
They weren't really charging. Well, yeah. I think it was...
He was going to do an eternity in service.
Yeah. Which is, even there, though, it's like... So that gets into, I think, my biggest problem with the movie, which is the last act or so. Basically, after they hit Ernest on the head twice with two vases, the... fantastic response where he gets hit the first time and he goes, what?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's when we get into this giant Hollywood party of the ultra elite who are, you know, very close to shunting.
Don't ask what that means if you have not seen Society.
I'm talking to you, Leona.
Yeah.
Wait a couple years before you watch that one.
Yeah. Oh my God, please.
And like, I found myself thinking once I started doing that, I was like, yeah, this is a little bit sweaty, because like, how do you really get out of this story? Just having the two of them make up. Okay. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then what's the final act of your story? And all of the goings on there just feel a little forced to me. Especially like the idea that Liesel would give him this potion so that he could basically be the plastic surgeon for everybody doesn't really track, because the whole thing, and also like the whole thing is she's like, yeah, you got to take care of yourself, and then they don't, and they end up dead, and they start falling apart. The only people who need him are Madeline and Helen. So like, why?
Yeah. I wonder if there's a little bit of like, all right, well, if we don't do something to take care of these two, they're going to blow our cover, because they're going to be walking corpses who are falling apart, and they could just go out in public and be like, hey, look at us, we're dead. Like, rat out the whole cabal. So, all right, fine. We'll help you get your plastic surgeon kind of husband.
Yeah.
And he will maintain you, and that way no one will catch on to what we're doing here.
Yeah. I know that I think there was excuse me. There was a decent number of reshoots done after they did some test screenings that didn't go very well.
I
don't know if the ending was something that they touched or whatnot, but
I can see that.
How do you feel about that last sequence at the party and everything?
Yeah, it feels kind of unnecessary to have it happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I understand them. I think the motivation for Madeline and Helen, who, by the way, I love that their nicknames are Mad and Hell.
I didn't catch that.
I really love that that's what they call each other.
Nice.
I think the motivation for having them want to get him the potion too, so that he's always around to sort of maintain them now that they need serious maintenance. It plays into the whole bigger theme of like, women aging and feeling that pressure to maintain a certain like level of youthful appearance. And it's good motivation for those characters. Even bringing him to Liesel's house, castle, whatever, palace, also makes sense to me, because they know where she lives. And they would absolutely, these two characters would absolutely go and be like, we would like more potion, please.
Right, yeah.
I think it makes less sense to have Liesel, like you were saying, quite so ready to hop on to help them. I think it's weird to have the big formal party happening.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think some of that gets a little bit like, what? Okay. All right. Oh, okay. We're doing this now. We're doing it like this.
This movie is, excuse me, close to 2 hours long, if not 2 hours.
Really?
And it's, I think so. I could be wrong. Maybe I was looking at the time incorrectly, but I think it's like an hour 40, hour 50 or something.
Yeah,
like that.
You got to be right. I know it's long. It was longer than an hour and a half, so.
And it still feels like there's stuff they kind of had to rush through. Like, yeah. I was really surprised how quickly they go through the first chunk of the story at the beginning, because it's like they do the Broadway thing. Madeline meets Ernest.
Yep.
And then like hard cut to them getting married.
I like 7 years later, and then another 7 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. They jump 7 years. Yeah. She's fat now. Yeah. She gets arrested for some reason. Is she getting evicted?
She gets evicted. And then I think because she won't leave, he's called the cops. And because she keeps rewatching scenes of Madeline getting murdered in her acting career, they're like, oh, she's gone crazy.
I actually really liked that movie she was watching, because it seemed to be a fake movie that I think was made up of footage from the Ipcress file, which is a Michael Caine movie, because I'm almost positive that was Michael Caine who was in that movie.
Oh, wow.
Because as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, yeah, because he had the big black glasses.
I never would have caught that.
It's something. It's a look he only had like in a couple movies, and I think it was for this very specific character from the Ipcress file. And so I think they were cutting that in with the reverse shot with Maddie. Madeline?
Yeah, you do keep calling her Madeline. Maddie. Madeline, Mad.
You know, we're buds.
Just call her Mad.
Mads.
Yeah.
But yeah, it feels like there's, it's one of those things where it feels like there's a lot missing where, okay, they bring him to Liesel.
Yeah.
How does Liesel react to this? That seems like it could have been a scene.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, it's like, well, do you really need that? I don't know.
Right, right. If we're already butting up past an hour 40
yeah.
and we feel like we're hustling through a bunch of other stuff, it would be kind of weird, I guess, to have it be like, oh, let's pause here and see what Liesel thinks. Because I think Liesel plays a very specific role in this movie of just coming and being alluring and,
yeah.
and offering this sort of... deal with the devil style, like take this potion, live forever kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the one other way they could have done the ending, which maybe wouldn't have been as hit the right note they were looking for, is I think there's a version where Madeline and Helen ruin it for everybody.
Yeah.
Where they go to Liesel and somehow
offend her so much that she shuts off the tap or
they
something.
They accidentally destroy the source or something like that.
But I'm glad they didn't do that, because I think if you start getting into the source of the potion then all of that stuff, it gets like, okay, yeah.
This fist fight with James Dean.
That would be fun. That would be fun, watching Goldie Hawn fist fight with fake James Dean.
Yes.
I would have been into that.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the only part that... by that point, I think it's just like we're just wrapping this up. You know, we have to do a couple more things to keep you engaged, and then we can kind of...
And then, like, if we're going to be shooting in this giant castle.
Right.
This giant castle set, we might as well use it.
Yeah. But that final funeral scene's really good.
Yeah. Them squabbling in the back and getting progressively louder and people having to keep turning and staring at them cracks me up every time.
Yeah. And I love the walks they're doing.
Yeah.
Because they're like all rigor mortis.
They each have their like Ministry of Silly Walks walk going on. One has like the knees turn in and the other one's just like a robot who can't move their legs right.
I love their gnarly faces.
Yeah.
And I love that they fall down
Meryl
the stairs.
Meryl Streep's ridiculous eyebrows.
I love that they fall down the stairs and explode. I'm sorry, I'm yawning into the microphone.
Oh, my God.
Oh, give me some of that juice. To make you not tired anymore.
Where is Liesel? Where is she?
One of the things that I really like about this overall is that even though it's set in a very specific timeline, because it starts in 1978 and then it jumps 7 years ahead and then it jumps 7 more years. And then even more,
37 years.
The whole movie feels very out of time, because it almost feels like it should be taking place in like the 50s or something, because of the style of dress and the Madeline's house and stuff has a very sort of retro Hollywood kind of feel.
Yeah, the old Hollywood vibes. Yeah.
I don't watch this and go, oh, this feels like it takes place in 1992.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I do think it's kind of funny watching this, though, like, maybe when I was younger, it was much easier to notice. But now that I myself am older and this movie is all about aging, I had a much harder time clocking. Like, I was looking at Meryl Streep and being like, I don't understand why everybody's acting like she looks so bad.
Like, yeah, well, that's...
She looks great. And then they oomph her up again and she looks even better, but she always looks great. Like,
yeah, that like...
The difference isn't very striking.
They give her like a little bit of like old age face makeup.
Yeah.
But it's very subtle.
Yes.
And I feel like you can see it more on Bruce Willis than you can on her.
Yes.
And even, yeah, once she takes the thing,
right.
they do kind of a throwback to one of the first like great special effects scenes in the 19, I want to say 35 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where they do this great effect, black and white, right? Mm. So they do this great effect where Dr. Jekyll takes the potion and then he goes over to a mirror and fully in camera, his face changes and like his eyes get really dark. And they did it by using a red filter and then they paint it, green filter, and on his face they painted green paint in the areas they wanted to get dark.
Oh.
And then they dropped a red filter over it. And since red and green are contrary colors, the green comes through the red and it looks black.
Oh.
So it's very, very cool dissolve. And they kind of do something kind of similar when she goes over to the mirror and she's got that light on her that makes her look kind of gaunt, and then the lighting kind of changes and her face gets nice big and bright and stuff. But yeah, I was thinking kind of the same thing, where it's like when she gets that pneumatic bra or whatever, pops her boobs up, I was like, I don't know, aren't they looked okay to me?
Right. She's like, actually looked more comfortable before. Just looked like she wasn't maybe wearing a push-up bra. Now she
I did notice, because she's wearing that like sweatsuit kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
They do make a point of showing she does kind of have a dumpy butt. Which then once she takes the thing and they go,
yeah, it just goes back to her real butt. Yeah.
A lot of dumpy ass shots in this movie.
And then some great ass shots.
That's
too.
True.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Body double.
Isabella Rossellini?
Yeah. It was actually Catherine Bell, who old people might know from the TV show JAG, which is a show about law.
In the Air Force.
In the Air Force or possibly Navy. I can't remember which one.
Anyway,
do you think, just as like a general
question about JAG officers?
Listen, watch your language.
Children might be listening to this episode.
Do you find it at all ironic that there are so many movies and stories coming out of Hollywood about the dangers of being obsessed with vanity?
Uh-huh.
When...
we are more obsessed with vanity than ever.
Well, especially Hollywood. Hollywood has always trafficked in that, figuratively and literally.
Yes.
And so I always find it a little bit ironic and kind of, I don't know if self-serving is the right term.
Yeah, a little hypocritical.
Hypocritical. Yeah, I think that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, you have a movie like this that... if we want to get highfalutin about our themes for a second, it shows two women struggling and doing everything they can to stay young and beautiful looking as their only means to be relevant and powerful.
Right.
Meanwhile, the male character, who is arguably just as guilty of being crappy as the other two, he ends up escaping this cycle and he goes on to age and die.
Right.
And we get to see his funeral at age like 87. And nobody talks anything about what he looks like. Mm-hmm. Everybody talks about the beautiful legacy he's left behind in his family and his friends and all of his good works around the world and And the lesson is like,
he was a great man, but oh, he looked like shit.
But with the women, the lesson is sort of like, the lesson of this movie seems to be like their vanity is what has caused them to come to this sort of ridiculous end, right? Of being shattered on the front steps of the church, whereas Ernest got to live a life, and the priest is saying he found the genuine secret to eternal youth and the genuine secret to immortality. And it is these beautiful relationships he built in his lifetime.
Yeah.
And the point is that Helen and Madeline are bitter and still bickering and falling apart, and they're trapped together for eternity.
Well, the strange thing about it too is Madeline definitely is driven by vanity. Helen is not really driven by vanity. She's driven by revenge, and she's weaponizing.
Right.
Like the only thing Madeline knows is beauty.
Right.
And so she is using beauty as a weapon.
Yes.
I wouldn't. And like at a certain point, I think she ends up kind of in the same camp as Madeline, especially after they both die.
Yep.
But it isn't. It's Helen's drive isn't vanity the same way it is Madeline's.
Sure, but she definitely uses her good looks.
Oh, of course.
Like the whole book that gets her successful again is The Secret to Eternal Youth, or whatever she titles it.
Right.
It's
which is, I think, a fairly prescient commentary on
pivoting to wellness influencer.
And presenting a secrets to wellness from a person who is very unnaturally performance enhanced, let's put it that way.
But I think it's interesting seeing this movie as sort of like a precursor to a movie like The Substance.
I was thinking about The Substance and that's another one where, have you seen that?
No, not yet.
Man, it's so great. There's no missing the theme in that one.
Right.
Garth Marenghi would love that movie. But like that's another one where I was like, you're making this movie about the horrors of then the self-destructive nature of trying to cling to your youth and mm-hmm. your beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody who's in this movie shows up to the Oscars
looking youthful and gorgeous. Yeah. Yeah.
Botoxed up.
Yep.
Siliconed up.
Yep.
Whatever upped.
And these things are more and more accessible to like yeah. normal people. Like you can just go get Botox.
Right.
Like it's not hard to find. It's expensive, but it's not.
Not the way I do it.
Not the way you do.
No,
you get your own botulinum toxin cultures.
Anytime I make chicken, you know, the juice that's in the bottom of the chicken thing.
That's salmonella.
I just stick my face in it. Yeah.
You just rub it all over your face every yeah. night.
It's salmonella. Well, that explains why it's not working.
Yeah.
And I've been throwing up for the past 3 weeks. Yeah.
But yeah, it is always interesting having these movies because it is, you know, these movies are pointing out a real thing in our society, right?
Yeah.
Like it really happens. There is really pressure on people in general, but women especially, to continue to be young and beautiful
mm-hmm.
and to feel scared. And there's that whole kind of monologue that Liesl gives Madeline where she talks about, you know, you have this body that you think you know and you think you understand, and then it begins to betray you.
Yeah.
And that's a real experience that people have with aging. And so, of course, we're going to have movies made about that.
I was just watching the new Hulk Hogan documentary.
Oh, boy.
And he basically says those exact words.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, then there is that weird feeling of like, but you're doing it with like beautiful Hollywood actors.
Yeah. Like, and you know, it's a,
who all look amazing all the time anyway, and are like, have teams of people maintaining.
Yeah.
Their image.
And it's always, oh, I mean, of course she's going to get an Oscar nomination. She's so gorgeous, but in the movie she looks so gross.
Yeah. Yes. You know? Yeah. Yeah. The Charlize Theron.
Yeah. I mean, even The Substance, you know, Demi Moore. And it's like, it's weird too, because I fall for it every time.
Mm.
Like with The Substance, like, man, that's so awesome that Demi Moore played this. It's very, you need to really have you have to let go of your self-consciousness to do a role like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, but she's also still Demi
she's
Moore.
She's also still Demi Moore, yeah.
I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, I don't know how cynical or not cynical to be about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's better to make the movies about these issues, even if they're being made inside of a system that makes it pretty hypocritical.
Yeah.
Than to not make these movies at all.
Yeah.
Right.
I guess
it's Hollywood. Like inherently you're kind of stuck dealing with like the good juicy roles are going to go to like popular and well-regarded actors who are going to be beautiful people.
Yeah.
So you're kind of trapped into the system.
Yeah. The most cynical version of this kind of idea is like anytime I see, you know, like when Nike was putting Colin Kaepernick on everything after the kneeling thing, it's like, you don't give a shit about what he did.
No.
You just know that supporting him is going to sell shoes.
Yes. Welcome to capitalism, Clay.
I'm glad
you're here.
Yeah. That's, I mean, explains why I don't have any money. but you know, it's just like that kind of thing where it's like you want to be able to kind of like nod your head and feel like they're hitting these topics that are real and that you agree or care about.
Yeah.
But ultimately, there's a certain shallowness to all of it.
100%.
And you just learn this more and more as you get older.
Yep.
So.
At least you're not a woman.
Well, not with that attitude. Yeah. So overall, I think this movie's great.
I agree.
After I went on that screed about the cynical nature of making movies about how beauty's not everything by the industry that only caters in beauty being everything.
Yes. But
yeah, I don't know why it's not, it wasn't more well received at the time. And you know, it's only a 63 on the audience score.
I feel like I could see this movie being misunderstood as, oh, two women who are just awful.
Mm-hmm.
right? Like a very surface understanding of this movie would be two women who are just horrible. And they're
one guy who's just trying to figure it out.
Or just one guy who's also like, ugh, him? Why are you fighting over him? Like, he's not even good looking. Yeah. And like, they're terrible. And it's just...
Didn't you see his tiny rimmed glasses? Yeah. He's ugly. He's a nerd.
But yeah, I could see the 1992 view of this being like, ugh. I don't want to sit through a movie that's just two women fighting over Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
And, you know, missing out on some of the more subtle nods and little bits in between that we, as people who have streaming services, means we can rewatch movies whenever we want. So it's easier to pick up on some of that stuff.
Do you think this movie would do better if it came out now?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I think this movie or something like it would do much better. If it came out now.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is timing for this one.
Yeah.
because it's 92 is kind of a weird time for genre stuff in general. Mm. And yeah, it's kind of it's definitely a comedy, but it's kind of got horror elements in it, and it's a little over the top, and the design almost feels like they're trying to do the Batman thing a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. So it's definitely campy. It's definitely
a little hard to peg this one.
Yeah.
But I think it's great. Should watch it.
Yes.
Would you put this on our list?
Probably not, just because I don't think it's scary enough.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I wouldn't put it on the list. I think that's the thing, right? You could do a version of this that's straight horror. And it's, you wouldn't have to change that much.
No, just some tonal stuff.
Yeah. The substance kind of is this to a certain extent.
Right. Frankenstein, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If Dr. Frankenstein built himself, sewed himself back up.
Made his wife the monster.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever see the Kenneth Branagh Frankenstein?
No.
No? They do that they in that one where his Frankenstein's wife dies. And then the monster's like, eh? And so he's like, fine. And he brings his wife back to life.
As a Frankenstein.
As a Frankenstein. It's a horrible monster. I think this is great. I probably wouldn't put it on the list.
Yeah.
But it's definitely worth watching.
Absolutely.
So that's going to do it for Death Becomes Her.
Yes, it is.
We're going to hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. Next time, we will be doing number 118, which is Island of Lost Souls from 1933, which is one of the first adaptations of The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yes.
With more Bela Lugosi and less weird Marlon Brando.
I am always here for more Bela Lugosi.
Yeah. So if only he had known that when he was alive.
Yeah.
Maybe he would have got better roles. Did you know he only played Dracula twice?
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, if you don't count the stage production, but like on film, he only played him twice.
Yeah, he only did twice. Yeah.
That's wild. Iconic. Iconic.
Fully iconic.
He was an icon.
We have to end this episode. Are losing your mind.
I was trying to think of some Gen Z slang to call him, but I couldn't. He was mother back then.
I don't even think that's Gen Z.
I don't know. I don't know where I am or what year it is. All right. Thank you guys for listening. If you want to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. Again, we can follow us when our coverage of sequels and our special episode from the Stanley Hotel in a couple months. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks, Clay.
Happy birthday, Leona. We'll
see
you next time.
Happy birthday, Leo. Bye.